This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. Now, Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome. It's Monday, time for our Zoomer squad. And is it possible that U.S. President Joe Biden struck a blow against ageism? The ageism that surrounds him anyway. His strong performance in the State of the Union address last week in a feisty speech that lasted more than an hour allayed, or should have allayed, a lot of concerns about whether he is still with it. Well, we'll see what the panel thinks. And last week, we also got a date for the federal budget. What's CARP looking for? And we also heard the latest dire warning about the lack of family doctors, especially here in Ontario, where apparently 2.3 million people do not have a family doctor. And that is something that I bet affects Zoomers disproportionately because doctors their own age are retiring. The numbers to call, 416-360-0740, toll-free 1-866-740-4740.
And now, time for the Zoomer Squad.
And now I'd like to welcome Rudy Boutignol, president of CARP, Anthony Quinn, chief community officer of CARP, and John Wright, executive vice president of Maru Public Opinion. Hello, everybody, and happy Monday. Happy Monday after daylight saving time.
Happy March break.
Happy March break. I don't know that that's significant for people in our demo. Let's talk about Joe Biden. So, Rudy, did you watch the address and what did you think?
I was impressed. You know, the key issue was his ability to speak and think. And I think he did all those things. I think he was really full of piss and vinegar. I think he was sharp. He was feisty, as you mentioned, and he was able to deal with the hecklers in the crowd. You know, so he's—I think he was with it. He wasn't just reading off the teleprompter. I think he did what he needed to do for the people that are open to considering the possibilities.
Okay, well, I think you really hit it there for the people who are open. What indications do you have that his performance might have changed people's minds, certainly on the age front?
I thought the bar was set very low for Joe Biden. All he had to do was not have a train wreck like he had the month earlier when the special counsel had called him a well-meaning elderly old man with a poor memory. So he was trying to change the tune on that impression of him and deliver a speech for an hour from a teleprompter. So the bar was low. There was no train wreck, as I think the nation was tuning in to watch. But he's got a number of months to continue to prove that he can do that on the campaign trail, and that's yet to be seen.
Again, you know, people are so polarized and so much in their own realities in the States. You've got to wonder, you know, I'm not looking to see if they've changed their mind politically, but changing the conversation is whether age is still going to be such a big part of the conversation.
Well, they're both elderly candidates in the United States, Trump and Biden. They're in their senior years. And when Biden went off the teleprompter, he was able to engage with the audience. He was sharp and everything. And when I see Donald Trump doing the same thing and he goes off the teleprompter, he's incoherent.
But he's always been that way.
Yeah, but it's amazing that it's not really – they're speaking to the converted, obviously, in many ways. It's the – I guess it's the independents, the people that are open to thinking, like, which candidate am I going to vote for? That's who this is to appeal to.
Yeah, the big problem is in the conversation I hear, particularly on the pundits in the U.S., is they're confusing competence with age. And they will say, is he too old to govern, or is Trump too old? And the question should certainly be about their competence to govern, regardless of their age. And that's where we fall into that discrimination, the age discrimination line. If we're talking about someone purely based on their age and not their skill set or their ability, that's when we're into discrimination territory.
Well, you know, just in society as a whole, ageism is just about the last acceptable ism. So it's not surprising. I'm wondering also how much of it is a physical attribute thing, because Joe Biden is really stiff the way he walks. He's got arthritis, and Donald Trump isn't.
I think the physical view of Biden, when you see him walking to the helicopter on the lawn, it does make you wonder about the physicality, but it's really a question about his brain. I mean, the idea, you know, we are supposed to respect our elders. Our elders know stuff, but we know when we visit our own elders, they might be in an easy chair. They might be sitting down. They're not out playing baseball. But you don't expect that when you go talk to your grandparents, for instance, right? And you go to them, young people, I certainly did, and they impart words of wisdom. They've seen a lot of life, and they give you their wise advice, but you don't expect the physical aspect of it. And I guess the difference in the United States in political campaigns is that you've actually got to run for office. So that's the difficult part, not governing, but campaigning.
Oh, I think governing is pretty difficult, too. Let's bring in John Wright. John, have you seen any evidence that the whole age issue surrounding Biden has eased since his State of the Union speech?
It hasn't changed a bit. I mean, the only people that surprised that night were the media, the New York Post, who posted the next day, he's alive. And people in the White House who basically, you know, held their breath while the commander-in-chief went out and took the stage. Look, in politics, it's not one night that makes it. And the reality is, in politics nowadays, social media, advertising, you know, directly to people, causes people to, I mean, there's that phrase, paint somebody's wagon before they get a chance to paint your own. This is being painted for some time. I mean, Joe Biden's coming out. He's going to, we saw him the next day out at another function. It may be energizing some Democrats over it, but I think in the short term, it hasn't done anything, nor will it.
Really? And that's because they're so polarized. I mean, I would assume that most people didn't even watch the speech, but certainly listened to the spin on it, and the spin would come from their own camp. Right, John?
Well, I mean, I'm sure all of us would have stuck around for a 2.5-hour speech if the prime minister had made it, right? Not at all. I mean, you know, and then he hung around the chamber for another hour. I mean, he showed that he wasn't old. But Libby, you and I and all of us here have been around politics to know that he had a good night because he came out feisty. And the next morning he jumped off a plane step and went to another rally, and he was feisty there. But I mean, honestly, for the last year, he's been, you know, portrayed as a doddering, old, stuttering man. That's how he has been portrayed versus his rival that, regardless of what you think of him, is energetic every day at the podium and saying all kinds of stuff. So the contrast is not going to be erased in one 24-hour span. The polling that took place the night was the dial polling, where you get Republicans, Democrats, and Independents to kind of look at this stuff. And yeah, it had a bump, but you can't erase 6 months of intense advertising, especially to, as you rightly pointed out, a very polarized audience that, you know, comes down to 7 states at the end of the night by a thin margin who's going to win the presidency. So I don't think it had much of an impact at all.
Okay, let's take a call from Bill in Toronto. And Bill, our board here says it's about his mental acuity, but wouldn't you think, whether you agree with him or not, and I'm sure you don't, that just navigating that speech showed that he is he's with it. His mental situation is fine.
Well, your last commentator, when he said feisty and energetic, that's what I always look for in my politician. When I'm going to cast my vote, those are the top two things. And as far as him being feisty in that speech, I think they must have had the guy drugged up. Let's look at this realistically. Hang on. You know, the guy tripped upstairs. He's fallen down. He's walked around stages. He's gone to shake people's hands that aren't even there. You know, he's tripped over himself up on a stage. He's sat up there and mumbled incoherently, I mean, more times than anybody can count. How the hell can anybody even, if this is, you, that's what you want to put out to run the strongest world in the country, to lead the world?
Okay, I think we get the drift of what you think. You know, Donald Trump is not immune from this stuff. He's mixed up Barack Obama and other presidents and Joe Biden and Nancy Pelosi and Kamala Harris. I mean, I don't even know how you could mix that up. So he's not, but again, it seems like for people whose minds are made up, it isn't going to go anywhere. I'm going to take another call from Kathy in Niagara Falls. Hello, Kathy.
Hi. Hi, Libby.
Hi. Go ahead.
I just think it comes down to the guy. Like, I don't care how old Trump is. He's an idiot. He should be in jail now instead of running for president. You know, did you see at Ormond, is it Ormond or Orban?
Viktor Orban, yes.
Yeah, he wants to be a dictator, and this is what the United States is getting into by if they elect him. Are they crazy?
Some people would think so. Thank you for your call. Again, I wasn't trying to get into Biden versus Trump and whether you like them or not, just this whole ageism issue, and I think we've kind of covered it. So let us move along. We also got a date for the Canadian federal budget, something not quite as exciting as the State of the Union address in terms of what people follow. So, Rudy, what is CARP looking for?
You know, specifically, it'd be good to see supports for people to stay at home, but non-institutional supports, not the big sexy announcements of more hospitals and care units, which would be good, but take a long time to build, and there's not going to be
enough. You mean aging in place?
Aging in place. And really looking for non-institutional support, the way to engage family and friends and neighborhoods to help people stay in their home. Things like tax credits and that, because there is no way with the size of our aging demographic that governments can solve most of this. It's going to take the great social safety net of families that have the ability to look after their own, to help those people help their elders.
John, are people paying attention to the budget? And what about this worry that, you know, we're broke, but the Liberals are going to spend money they don't have, money our money?
Wow. Well, let's put it this way. We have five provincial budgets that will happen before April the 16th when the federal budget comes down. So a lot of the questions that many will be answered by the provincial governments who have jurisdiction over health care and things like that. So Ontario is in the window. We'll see whether they're going to keep counting long-term care beds as homes. You know, those are the kind of things that are done right on the ground. I think the second thing is people are going to be looking for affordability measures in the budget. And you can even look at the Conservatives who have had their campaign about the tax on the carbon tax, things like that. People want relief, and they're certainly not going to get it from the Bank of Canada for the next little while. But the other issue, as you rightly pointed out, is the government is going to come in with a $46 billion deficit. I mean, it's up, $6 or $7 billion from last year. We're running a $1 trillion plus deficit at the moment, and everybody wants money. And I know that, Anita Anand is out trying to, as the Treasury Board Secretary, trying to cut back in things like the Defense Department, where she's ripping out $800 million from it. But, I mean, that's a drop in the bucket. So I think the other issue really is not so much just what the Liberals are going to do with the NDP and spending, but then look across the Altimister Polia, because if the Conservatives get in, they're going to have to reprioritize what's important in this country, and they're going to have to decide what they're going to cut, because we're running out of room in terms of how much money and flexibility we have.
Yeah, and at this point, it really does look like they will get in, though it will be a while. Anthony, in terms of CARP again, what are your members looking for?
Well, affordability, like John said, is one of the priorities. The federal government has been quite quiet on seniors' issues the last two budgets. We saw a 10% increase for those over age 75 with their old age security.
And it took two elections after the announcement to get that money.
But CARP has always been concerned about splitting that demographic into two cohorts, the 65 to 75 and the 75 plus. So looking for the old age security to increase for that 65 plus, long promised yet overdue. Also, we heard from the federal minister of seniors at our AGM a few weeks back, and we once again brought up the issue of the mandatory withdrawal of RIF savings, and CARP is looking to remove that mandatory portion so that people spend the money when they need it, not when they have to, according to the government.
Well, exactly. You know, you brought up that the Bank of Canada isn't going to be the one providing the relief. Now, a lot of Zoomers are on the other side of that. Younger people with mortgages want to see those interest rates come down. But people who are saving and who've probably been putting a lot more money in the market than, you know, our elders used to. Well, do you think that people should be rushing to cash in on decent interest rates for very safe investments while they're still there? I noticed that even at the beginning of the year, that we had a whole year where you could get 5% easily on a GIC, which is, I don't remember the last time for that. I think that's already gone. But do you have a view of that, Rudy?
Well, I don't think interest rates are going to go down for a while. Everyone keeps pushing it back. There's a general consensus that we've peaked, but there's no consensus on when interest rates might come down. And I don't think that when they do start to move, that they'll move significantly. I think that GICs are still pretty good because I can't believe the rates compared to what they were like a few years back.
But they're lower than they were.
They are. I think everyone's hedging their bets, you know, in terms of when are these rates cuts going to come. But every time I'm listening to the financial news, everyone keeps pushing it. Well, maybe it'll be this summer, maybe it'll be in the fall. So it's a volatile time right now. But I think that I think interest rates are going to stay approximately where they are for a long time.
John, is this something that is on the radar, especially of older people?
Well, it depends on, you know, how much of who's managing your money is one thing, because clearly they take a whack in the stock market not too long ago, and they've had to come back for that. Number two is that, I mean, you want to manage through these things so that you've got take advantage of things like the GICs. But I think at a more global level, it then comes back to affordability, as we've already touched on. But it seems to me that we might not get relief on the interest rates until probably the fall. But it does become inflationary when governments spend money, right? They put more money into the system. So on the one hand, you're giving money on food rebates and extra money for savings and a bunch of other things out there for people who are in different parts of the economy. And at the other hand, that is putting money back into the system in a disproportionate way so that it's causing interest rates to go up. So in a way, government and the Bank of Canada, I mean, take a look at the Bank of Canada. When it has measured inflation, the number one thing that's causing inflation is interest rates. So we got a situation where government and the Bank of Canada are kind of, you know, chasing their tail. I suspect that it takes about 13 to 15 months for things to ripple through the economy, which means that the first cut might not come until the fall. But, I mean, it can't always be about, you know, one group in society. There are many who are suffering through this at the moment, and they're looking for even a small amount of relief.
Well, the good news that the government will be able to tout once again will be the dental care plan. That actually is something that will change the lives of tens.
Yeah, but how close are we to actually seeing it in practice?
In practice, they've promised starting as early as May. So they may have more information available in the budget, but they'll also have to plan out how much they're going to spend in the budget. So we'll see some details on where they'll spend it and how they'll spend it and to whom it will apply.
Well, again, with that dental care plan, dentists have to opt in or opt out. And dentists are sort of screaming that they don't have enough information or that the fees they're going to get are less than what they get now. So, I mean, May is going to come around sooner than we think.
It's hard to see it happening in May. I mean, obviously, dental care is essential to good health. And I think funding it's a great idea, but a government has to choose on priorities. So if you're going to fund that, what are you not going to fund? And, you know, right now the government seemed to be funding anything.
So. Well, exactly. And speaking of health, so we had another dire warning from the Ontario Medical Association last week about the lack of family doctors. And again, since we're talking about our demo, I would think it affects our demo disproportionately because people, when they pick a family doctor, usually pick somebody their own age or older.
That is an issue. I confronted it myself. I had a doctor that was relatively my age, and we've both gotten older. And I was only because I moved to Vancouver and had to look for a new family doctor that we found someone younger. And the only way we got in was through a referral. And their practice is closed. And it's a real problem is getting family doctor. And that's what most people want. And I don't think people want the telehealth is great, an emergency, but you want that.
You need a family
doctor.
And this is not, I mean, people say it's the result of some crisis, but we've known about this wave of boomer doctor retirements for a long time, Anthony.
But completely tied into the wave of boomers who will need those services.
Yeah.
So the doctors are retiring, but the cohort is also exceptionally large, and they'll continue to need more and more services by these doctors as they're aging. So we have a shortage of boomer doctors who are retiring, but their client base is growing, and it's growing. It's going to double 50% more in the next 10 years.
You had a great story from your sister.
Oh, my sister lives in Timmins, Ontario, and she was telling me that her doctor has retired, and there's no new doctor available to take the place of that 5,000 patient list. So she's not sure what to do. She's not in immediate need of a family doctor, but for the residents of far-flung places like Timmins, Ontario, the shortage is much more acute. Let's not talk about outside of Ontario and in eastern Canada, where there are absolutely no family doctors available.
Well, I have a story too. And as I've said many times, my family doctor is 83 years old. He's great. He's really with it. And I talk to him on the phone when I need to, and sometimes we send him pictures of things. And he does go into the office, but not all the time. So I had to see someone last week. And I ended up getting an appointment with a very young doctor. And I went in there thinking, well, gee, you know, maybe she'll be the one if my doctor ever decides to retire. And we're not pushing him. We like him where he is. And I walked in there, and she was very nice and everything, but I walked shaking my head. I said, she's not that knowledgeable. Well, I don't think I want her as my family doctor.
That reminds me of the conversation about Biden earlier. It's all about competence. It's not about age. It's about the competence and the experience. And that's what you would prefer.
Well, exactly. I'm not saying she's not competent, but she's certainly not a lot of experience. John, again, with the doctor shortage, what have you found?
Well, you know, I have to confess, I worked with the Ontario Medical Association 30 years ago doing polling for them. And I was around when Bob Rae, in fact, choked off the doctors. I mean, it took a long time for more doctors to get into the system because the NDP believed that was the way to stop spending so much money. And it stayed for a while. I think you're right. There's a demographic issue here that's affecting both doctors and the public. there's also, you know, lots of people who say that we throw money at it and we'll get people. We'll go to some of the rural communities where they're offering homes and lots of money and lots of things. I mean, go to the Ottawa Valley, not too far north of the new medical college that's going to be in Ottawa, and you still can't get people. If that one doctor leaves in Eganville, I don't know what anybody in the valley is going to do. So the real issue for me is twofold. One is, what can we do with technology? You know, maybe there is a way. There are some programs out there where you can kind of plug and play your television, where it can automatically connect to a nurse practitioner or a pharmacist who can give you
nurse
prescriptions.
Nurse practitioners have to be funded here. They're not funded.
And these are the issues, though, that we have to confront. It's, if you've got thousands of people that need assistance and you expect them all to go into an office and sit there for an hour to get it and then go all the way home, then it's inefficient for both the system and for the patient. And I think, you know, when push comes to shove, we're going to have to start making some of these decisions about getting just people who can help you, as opposed to being in front of somebody and telling them what you need.
Well, as I said, you know, certain things become suddenly available when they're funded, like phone consultation with your doctor or Zoom consultation. And now nurse practitioners, they can do a lot of things, but they're not funded. So people don't want to pay out of their own pocket. So they have to be funded. And we're running out of time, but I'll just say one more thing about this is that younger doctors are practicing differently. They're not spending 40 or 50 or 60 hours a week in their practice. Some of them have kind of different subspecialties, or they're doing other things. And I think that has an impact as well.
Yeah, my doctor is a young, youngish person. She's got kids, about 10, 12, and she takes, you know, she's got a regular life. She's not burning the candle at both ends, and it's not the old style. It's a doctors also pursuing healthier lifestyles.
Okay, well, that's good too. On that note, we wrap things up. Thanks so much, Rudy Boutignol, Anthony Quinn, and John Wright. We'll talk again soon. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thanks, Libby.
Okay, we are taking a break, and when we come back, boy, late Friday afternoon, don't you love those announcements? Canada announced that it was resuming funding to UNRWA, and that is the Palestinian Relief Organization, the UN organization, and a lot of countries suspended the funding because of evidence that some of their people participated in October the 7th. When we come back, we will be talking to a former Canadian ambassador to Israel. We'll take that break now.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to 1. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. It was one of those late Friday afternoon announcements, even more relevant in this case because many Jewish organizations were already closed for the Sabbath. Minister of International Development Ahmed Hussein announced that Canada is resuming funding to UNRWA, despite the fact that the investigation that they originally said they were waiting for is not complete. Now, at that point, the government announced that it was suspending funding after Israel alleged and provided evidence that some UNRWA employees participated in the October 7th attacks, killing and taking hostages. Now, the whole thing seems to me a bit of a charade because Canada never really suspended funding. We made an early payment to UNRWA before announcing the suspension, and now we were the first country to announce that we will resume the funding. So I'm scratching my head a bit over that, but what it means is that Canadian taxpayers never stopped funding this organization, which, you know, the uproar was about people who allegedly participated in October 7th, but there are active Hamas members in there. Anyway, Israel's ambassador to Canada says he was surprised by the decision. And now a former Canadian ambassador to Israel joins me to unpack these. The numbers are 416-360-0740, toll free 1-866-740-4740. And we go to Vivian Berkovich, a Canadian lawyer, academic, and former ambassador of Canada to Israel. Hello, Vivian. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Livy.
So, first of all, what is your reaction to hearing this on Friday?
No surprise. I think that, in fact, Canada, the EU announced that they were resuming funding, and about 30 seconds later, Canada jumped in as well. So as soon as somebody else did it, Canada was going to jump in. But as you pointed out, and I'm so glad you did, Canada never actually suspended funding. They made a payment of some $23 million that was not due until April, early, months early. That's unheard of. Like, that never happens in the world of international aid. And they actually made that payment. And then Hussein came out and said, oh, we're pausing our payments to UNRWA, which was a complete falsehood. And not only that, but a few days after that announcement, he came out and said, oh, and we're adding another $40 million to various organizations on the ground, like World Food Program and a few others. But the fact is that they contract with UNRWA because they actually don't have the capability, the operational ability to distribute the aid in Gaza. So it was cheeky of Hussein, but he and his people surely knew that World Food, Red Cross, and any other groups to whom they donated money for the Gaza Strip was going to then be subcontracted to UNRWA.
So what is, first of all, this government does a lot of things that are total virtue signaling. So what were they trying to signal by announcing that they were pausing funding, even if they didn't? What was the point of that?
Oh, that was just kind of, you know, everybody else in the West had expressed outrage about a bunch of things that had been exposed. And so, you know, they don't really act on principle. So they just did it to sort of look like they were in line with other Western countries. That's what I take out of it. That's how I understand it. But, you know, you mentioned in the opening that, you know, there were quite a number of UNRWA employees who were shown without a doubt to have participated in the October 7th massacre and subsequently. So, you know, UNRWA employees, including a teacher and a physician and others, have imprisoned civilian hostages in their homes. They have tortured them. They have starved them. But there's more to it than that, because the UNRWA hospitals and schools were all hosting Hamas tunnels, weapons storage. I mean, there's so much evidence supporting these claims. But then the really big kind of, you know, bang came when UNRWA headquarters in southern Gaza, in Rafah, the city where the last sort of power of Hamas is centered now, their headquarters there turns out sat atop what they call a server farm, which is like this huge kind of, you know, computer control hub for Hamas. And I mean, all these cables and wires and all kinds of crazy stuff was using UNRWA power. And, you know, and you can see it coming up through the floor. And UNRWA, the head of UNRWA, Philippe Lazzarini, said, I had no idea, which was a complete lie. And that's when the West really went kind of apoplectic.
Well,
on the funding.
We have seen, Vivian, pictures of all of this.
Yes,
we've
exactly.
seen pictures of all of this. So how can anyone throw, I mean, I understand there has to be a formal investigation, but we have seen this. And even there are some people who say, well, UNRWA doesn't have any choice. If they want to operate there, they have to make nice with Hamas. But, I mean, there can't be much doubt about this.
Yeah. So first of all, it's one thing to kind of make nice and cooperate. It's another to be completely co-opted by. And this has been going on for like two decades now, almost two decades in the Gaza Strip, but decades elsewhere. So there's no separation between Hamas and UNRWA in the Gaza Strip. But, you know, many of the offensive things that we can now prove about UNRWA and Hamas have also been ongoing in the West Bank, there's not a huge difference, you know, when you look at some of the activities of the Palestinian Authority. These are very corrupt, authoritarian, and deeply anti-Semitic organizations, not just anti-Israel. They hate Jews. So, I mean, for anyone to sort of pretend that they didn't know is a farce. Furthermore, you know, all of this money that goes to UNRWA, there is no oversight or accountability, not even within the UN system. This is something I've researched. This is something I know, both from when I was ambassador and from having done work subsequently. UNRWA takes the money, and if anyone wants to do an audit or look at the books or ask, you know, make sure that money didn't go to X, Y, or Z, they say, no, sorry, we take the money and then you go. Like, zero accountability. And, you know, the government of Canada, who I ATIP'd and pushed on this, said repeatedly and still says, oh, we have all these like super duper oversight, accountability enhanced, all this kind of, you know, voodoo talk. But the truth is, they don't. They're absolutely using all of this vague, imprecise language because they have no control and oversight as to where the money goes.
Well, and also even aid that gets there sometimes is resold by Hamas or goes to operatives.
Absolutely. Oh, I mean, this is so overly documented. I mean, that the truck aid convoys, they keep accusing Israel of holding up aid. Not true. Tons of aid gets through and it's on the other side waiting for, at checkpoints, waiting for someone to come and pick it up. There are only, I guess, so many Hamas thugs with weapons who are free to come in and drive the convoys or hijack them. Most of them end up being hijacked. You're quite right. Hamas hoards the goods for themselves and leave their own people starving. And yes, there's also a huge black market. Hamas takes the money, takes the humanitarian aid and sells it at extortionate prices. So, like, there are other... Like, you know, this whole UNRWA thing is just such a joke because, you know, with all these countries pretending, oh, we need UNRWA. You know, the whole world, there are disasters. There are humanitarian disasters that happen all the time, all over the world. And the UN OCHA, their regular sort of the major organization that takes care of refugees and disasters and this kind of urgent humanitarian aid, they operate everywhere in the world. They operate, they're nimble, they're mobile, they're well-funded, they're effective. They're just not controlled by Hamas. So all it's like only in the Gaza Strip can only UNRWA do this.
So
I'm sorry, but it's a crock. It's an absolute crock.
That was going to be my next question, is who else would be capable of distributing aid? So you're saying it's the UN High Commissioner for Refugees.
Absolutely. I mean, they have a very... very robust, sophisticated, well-developed disaster operation, you know, that goes all over the world doing this kind of stuff.
What about this American plan to build a pier to get aid in? What do you make of that?
So, you know, I was just talking about that yesterday with someone on my own podcast. And, you know, first of all, if they do it, it's not even going to be operational. Like if they started yesterday, it won't be operational for 2-3 months. Okay. And we're kind of hoping that by that time, it's not really necessary. But sure, go ahead, build a floating pier, bring in aid. Great idea. I have no problem with it. I don't think anyone does. In fact, you know, Netanyahu's even trying to take credit for it. Who knows if it was his idea originally or not. I know. But yeah, sure. Bring it in. Bring in the aid. Israel's not the holdup. It's the holdup on getting aid in. There are two holdups. One is Hamas that hijacks and hoards, and the other is Egypt. No aid is passing through the Egyptian border, but, you know, the West doesn't like to talk about that.
I'm looking at the clock. We're out of time. Very interesting conversation. What would you like to leave us with on this, Vivian?
I would like to leave you with the reality that the UN is very corrupt. UNRWA is very corrupt, and Canadian tax dollars are being sent directly to UNRWA and Hamas, and the money is used to enhance the terror infrastructure and the tunnels. And keep in mind also that the four top leaders of Hamas are multi-billionaires, not millionaires, billionaires, and they did not make their money working in investment banking.
Okay. Vivian Berkovich, thank you so much for that. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Libby.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
We are taking another break, and when we come back, are you feeling tired today? First working day after changing the clocks? We'll talk about that annual ritual that a lot of people think is a waste of time when we come back.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. Are you feeling tired today? We lost an hour of sleep when we turned the clocks forward on the weekend, and now the debate about whether the change is good or bad continues. On the negative side, there is evidence of more car crashes, increased risk of heart attacks and strokes. On the positive, we do get another hour of daylight in the evening, but apparently it can take a whole week to recover. So what do you think? 416-360-0740, toll free 1-866-740-4740. And now I'm joined by Dr. Patricia Lakin-Thomas, Associate Professor in the Department of Biology at York University, and Dr. Michael Antle, Professor of Psychology at the University of Calgary, to discuss this issue. Hello, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Okay,
happy to be with you, Libby.
Yes, we've talked about this before, Dr. Lakin-Thomas, and is the evidence now overwhelming that this is not a great thing?
I think we're getting increasing evidence every year. Just a few years ago, frankly, I was a bit skeptical that there was much going on, but I think every year there are more studies coming out telling us about the negative effects, certainly of the spring forward. The fall back in the fall doesn't seem to have quite as big an impact, but the scientific community has come to a consensus about this, that this is not a good idea to be doing it every year.
And what is some of the key evidence?
Well, you've mentioned several of them, that we see increased rates of short-term effects in the spring forward. As you said, increased car accidents, heart attacks, workplace injuries, strokes, and even a report that judges give harsher sentences for a few days right after the time change.
Probably some people might think that's a good thing.
Well, not everybody agrees with that. So we're losing an hour of sleep, and we're also feeling a bit jet-lagged because our body clocks are now out of step with the sun time by an hour.
Dr. Antle, so what are some of the other effects of this?
Well, the big thing, I think a lot of people talk about this, is losing an hour of sleep, but then that happened. I think we all lost an hour last night, but it's actually going to take us quite a while. You mentioned a week. It could be longer than that for some people, might be a little shorter, because actually, as Pat just said, our body clocks are out of sync, so it's every day we've got to get up an hour earlier than our body clock is ready for, and it's not until dawn gets back to the right time for our body clock that we're going to start feeling better. So for some people, that could be a couple weeks. It's going to be about 4 weeks before dawn gets back to where it was on Saturday morning before we did this time change. And we know that with later sunsets, people tend to stay up later. We don't go to bed as early, and we still have to get up and go to work on time. So one of the big consequences of being on the wrong time is that we're actually sleeping less, and that adds up to over 100 hours less sleep over the whole year for people who are experiencing sunsets that are an hour later, and that can have serious health consequences from being chronically out of sync with the right time. So there's higher rates of obesity that go along with that, and heart disease and diabetes, and even some cancer rates go up with less sleep.
Is there an issue with the best kind of sleep, the REM sleep? Is that what people are losing, Dr. Lakin?
I think it's just the overall sleep, the total amount of sleep that you're getting. It's usually the deep sleep in the early night that we really need that's restorative. But we also need just the total amount of sleep to really do all that restoration and cleaning up the toxic waste, et cetera, in our brains and reforming our synapses so we can learn and consolidate what we learned. And it's a total amount of sleep that we need, really. I'm not sure. Mike, maybe you know REM versus non-REM deep sleep.
Deep sleep is the one that your body will make up first if you've had a bad night's sleep. So the body wants that. But as Pat said, you really do need enough sleep. And even if you get half an hour too little every night, that adds up. And that's why people like to sleep in on the weekends, is to catch up on that sleep debt that they've been accumulating all week long.
So what's the problem with changing this? I know there are even some jurisdictions like Ontario that said we want to change it, but we've got to wait for neighboring jurisdictions like Quebec and New York.
Well, what most jurisdictions have done is say, let's go to year-round daylight saving time. They think it would be great to have that extra hour of sun in the afternoon all year round. And daylight saving time, which we call summertime, sounds wonderful. Let's do summer all winter, like it's going to be warm and sunny in January, which it isn't. We're not saving any daylight. We're just shifting it later. It sounds great. The legislation in the U.S. is called the Sunshine Protection Act. Well, who doesn't want to protect sunshine? It has good press. But that's the wrong way to go. And what the scientific consensus is that we should be going to year-round standard time instead, ditch the changes and go to standard time. Ontario voted for daylight saving time year-round, but not until neighboring jurisdictions also agree. So it's ready to be triggered if the neighboring jurisdictions go to year-round daylight saving time, but that's the wrong direction.
Have any jurisdictions say we want to go to year-round standard time?
Well, Mexico just did it a couple years ago, and then Saskatchewan says that they're on standard time year-round, although they follow the wrong time zone, so they actually have daylight saving time like ours. A few places that have tried year-round daylight time, like Russia did back in 2012, after 2 years of experiencing daylight saving time winters, they gave up on it and went to standard time year-round, and that's where they're still at.
And is there evidence that they're doing better because of that?
They haven't repealed it. It took them 2 years of daylight savings time to get rid of it. I think they're still grumbling because they miss the later sunsets in the summer, but they are avoiding the winter depression that became much more prevalent there when they were on daylight savings time in the winter.
Heard that Oregon has voted for year-round standard time, but again, only when neighboring states also change. So it might be coming in some places.
Yeah, I think everybody's looking at their neighbors saying, you go. No, you go. Let's take a call from Daryl in Toronto. Hi, Daryl.
Hi, how you doing there?
Fine.
Anyway, I would like to know what the similar statistics are for every Tuesday after a holiday long weekend, because I would think that they're probably just as bad, if not worse. I don't think people get more sleep on a holiday weekend. And I don't think anyone's going to want to get rid of holiday weekends.
So the big difference between losing a night's sleep and the time change that we just had is that right now the sun is doing its own thing, and we're getting up an hour earlier relative to the sun. So it's the daylight that actually helps synchronize our circadian clock. And right now we're working against it. But when you've had a bad night's sleep, you wake up the next day, the sun's rising at the right time for your body clock, and that helps you get over it. So you can recover from staying up late or the social jet lag on the weekend because your time cues are in the right time. Same thing when you fly across time zones. So, you know, when you fly from one end of the country to the other, that could be a 3 or 4 hour time difference. But you get over it pretty quick because not only do you change your clock, but the time the sun is rising and setting changes as well. And that helps get your body clock on the new time zone. When you change the clock with the spring forward, that sunlight doesn't change with it. The sun doesn't know that you changed your clock, and neither does your body clock. And that's where the problem comes in.
What about melatonin? Can that help if people take a little bit of melatonin?
My understanding is that melatonin isn't as great as we used to think it might be. For some people, they may find that it helps a bit with sleep, but we haven't got good evidence, as far as I know, from animal studies or from humans, that it's really that effective at resetting our clocks. It might be a mild sleep aid for some people, but it's not a cure-all that we hoped it would be.
Dr. Antal, so what can people do?
Well, this week, I guess if you have a flexible schedule, just give yourself a little bit of extra time, maybe start a little bit later if you can. For people who work later in the day, who are maybe in the service industry, working at restaurants, and this probably won't affect them too much, but it's the people who have to get up and go to school, commute in, then this week, just give yourself some extra time.
And that's it? Nothing else other than that?
Well, seeing daylight is going to help synchronize your clock. You're just not going to be getting the morning light that your body clock needs to put it on the right time. Take a little nap if you need a little pick-me-up. If you're feeling a little draggy this week, that's okay, too.
And so what I gather from what you're saying is that it affects shift workers differently, and they might be better off.
Well, shift workers have a whole other set of problems.
Yeah.
So, because again, they're really getting up at very different times relative to what the sun's doing, and it can change on a regular basis. For us, we're all basically have become shift workers this week, and we've started a little bit earlier than we want to. For the other people, there's some bigger problems I think going on there that they hopefully have managed to adjust to.
And Dr. Lakin Thomas, I mean, we talk about this every year when the time hits. Is there any way to increase the conversation so that something might change?
Well, you're doing a good job, Libby, with this kind of a program. We have scientific societies in North America and in Europe who have been publishing position papers. We've all been talking to the media as much as we can. I think just talking to your neighbors and getting the word out that this isn't something we have to put up with every year.
Okay. Michael, Angel, anything you want to leave us with?
Well, a lot of people talk about the value of this extra hour of sunlight we're going to be having, but I'd like to remind people there's value in darkness, too, that it actually helps you fall asleep sooner. Most parents of young children will know this, that in the summer it's hard to get them to go to bed before the sun is set. And with these later sunsets, that's going to make it harder. So darkness actually is a good thing for us. It does help you get better sleep. And we know that sleep is one of the three pillars of good health, going along with exercise and a good diet. So everybody should try to get a good night's sleep.
Okay, good advice. Thank you so much, Dr. Michael Antal and Dr. Patricia Lakin Thomas. Bye-bye. And that is all the time we have for today.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.